Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Sarah Stevens, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of Robert H. Hinckley and the Noble Foundation. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in the government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Oil in the Middle East, Revolution and Counter-Revolution in the Arab World. Today's guest is David Ottaway. David Ottaway graduated from Harvard University and received his Ph.D. from Columbia. He worked 35 years for the Washington Post as a foreign correspondent in the Middle East, Africa, and Southern Europe, and later as a national security and investigative reporter in Washington before retiring in 2006. He has won numerous awards for his reporting at home, abroad, and he was twice nominated for a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He was a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in 1979 through 1980, and again in 2005 through 2006. He is currently a senior scholar. His expertise is in the Middle East, North Africa, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. Please join me in welcoming our guest. You have about 40 minutes, 50 total, but then for questions 50. After.
Well,
so
we'll leave time for questions.
Yeah.
Hi, welcome. I'm delighted to be here. I was in the Middle East in the early 80s and again in the 90s for the first Gulf War, and I keep going back there, and the Arab Spring has really fascinated me once again for the Arab world, because nothing happened there for much of the time. Although I was there when I arrived in 1981, the first thing that happened was the assassination of Anwar Sadat, and I was from here to the picture there away from him as he was being killed. So I have very vivid memories of my time. I spent a lot of time in Beirut covering the wars there. And so I've been fascinated by what's been going on since the Arab Spring 2 years ago. And as you all, I think, have a general idea, it is a total mess now. And there are conflicts galore happening all at the same time, one on top of the other. So I could talk to you about oil, and maybe if you raise the issue, but that's not what I wanted to try and explain. I wanted to try and unravel and explain some of the conflicts that are going on, and they're not the same conflicts in one part of the Arab world as they are in the other part of the Arab world, which is why I've handed out this map, which appeared in the New York Times earlier this year. And so what I want to do is talk about some of these conflicts that are assailing the Arab world. And then if we have time, and I want to save time to hear what you all are on your mind, so I'm not going to talk for 40 minutes. if we have time, I'll talk also about what I call the struggle for democracy in the Arab world, which was what it was all about to begin with, right? The Arab Spring was the pro-democracy groups rose up and they overthrew four Arab dictators. Incredible. Nothing like this has ever happened in the Middle East for centuries. So this is really big news and a big development for the Middle East. Now, what I want to try to do is I'm going to make seven different observations about the state of the Arab world now, and I hope this will give you some idea of the layers and the nature of the different types of conflict that they're dealing with now, are trying to deal with. And the first thing I want to talk about, you've probably all heard about Sunnis versus Shia and how they're fighting all across the Arab world, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it's not true. And this is why this map is very helpful. If you look at this map, you will see the blue is the area where the Shia are concentrated. And the red are where the Sunni are. And the Sunni, as you will see, are by far the most numerous. Sunni are about 90% of the Arab world, Shia about 10%. But the Shia are in Iraq, and an offshoot of the Shia, the Alawites, are in Syria. So that's why they're allied there. But if you look at this map, and starting from Egypt going west, the Sunni-Shia conflict plays no role whatsoever in the politics of those countries. They are heavily Sunni populations. They don't like the Shia. In fact, there was a Shia preacher who was strung up outside of Cairo this past summer. But they're not enough Shia to be a factor in the political equation. So the Shia-Sunni struggle begins sort of here on the coast with Lebanon and runs through Iraq. And that's the heart of where all the Sunni-Shia struggle is taking place. And then you have Shia down here along the coast that doesn't show up too well. But the Iranians use those Shias to try and push their Shia cause in Saudi Arabia and along the coast here, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates. But they are not very numerous. So when you hear about Sunni and Shia, think about this area. When you get to Egypt and you go west through Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, the key conflict is between secularists and Islamists. And believe me, it is just as strong and just as virulent as the conflict between the Sunnis and the Shia. And the secularists, there are secular political parties. There's a secular, when I say secular, it doesn't mean they're not Muslim. It means that they don't want to have an Islamic state. And they're opposed to the Islamic parties that have come to power in Tunisia. They were there in Egypt for 1 year. The prime minister of Morocco is actually from a Sunni Islamic party. And the secularists are really upset about this because they don't want to see women put on the veil. And they don't want, they're very westernized, starting with Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, very westernized. The women, I just came from Tunis. I'm always struck by this. In the streets, you have women cops directing traffic, arresting men for, you know, misbehaving. You go through the booth tolls on the highways, and you have women collecting the money. I mean, you don't see this anywhere else when you go in Egypt or anywhere else in the rest of the Arab world. Very modernized, very much part of Europe, southern Europe. And it's a whole different world. And so the secular influence is very strong in that part of Africa, and they're really upset about this Islamist who won the elections. And if we have time, I'll talk more about Egypt and Tunisia and what happened in those two countries. But okay, that's the first level of conflict. Now, another big issue that's come out of the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring is what they call the uprisings of 2011. Is that the boundaries and borders of a number of states in the what's called the Levant, this area from Lebanon through to Iraq, have been really shaken up, and they're being tested. And it is not at all clear that the boundaries, such as they are now, are going to survive, because a lot of these societies are made up of not only Shia but Christians and Sunnis and Turkmen and Kurds, and they're all now starting to fight to have their own homelands and maybe an independent state. And the one that's most likely to become an independent state is Kurdistan in northern Iraq, where my wife and I are going next Saturday, to find out whether or not they're going to become independent or not. But the pieces of the puzzle are all loosened and sort of up in the air, and nobody's quite sure whether these borders and boundaries that were established when the Ottoman Empire collapsed at the end of World War I, these borders were all sort of imposed on the area by the French and the British. And so now the question is, are they going to survive, or are we going to see the birth of statelets or semi-autonomous regions within these countries? And Kurdistan is particularly interesting to me. I'm about to go there and talk about oil. They are building a pipeline to Turkey, and it's going to start functioning at the end of this year, and they're going to be able to export about 150,000 barrels a day of oil, and that's enough for them to have an economic basis for their independence. So this issue of the borders, this again does not affect Egypt. This issue of borders, of the changing borders, does not affect Egypt going west. It affects particularly what's called the Levant, which is Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, in particular, those three areas. So this has got everybody really worried about whether we are really seeing the end of the colonial order, and that there's nobody around like the United States or the French or the British that are interested in trying to impose or maintain the old order. So this whole area is kind of up in the air about what's going to happen to it. That's the second issue I want to talk about. Now, as if this were not enough, there are at least four levels of conflict piled on top of each other. If you start at the bottom, you have the pro-democracy groups trying to overthrow the autocrats. And it's still going on in Syria, and they succeeded in Yemen, in Tunisia, in Libya, and in Egypt. So that's at the bottom. And then on top of that conflict, you have this Shia-Sunni conflict I was telling you about. And on top of that conflict, you have a political power struggle between Iran, which is the leader of the Shia population all across the Middle East. It's the one majority Shia. Well, Iraq is a majority, also has a majority of Shia, but just a slight majority. Iran is almost, I think it's 90%. What is it? 89% Shia. So it's kind of the heartland of the Shia. And they're Persians, they're not Arabs. And then you have Saudi Arabia, it's the cradle of Islam, that's where Mecca and Medina is, that's where Islam was born. And the Saudis feel they are the heartland of the Sunni world and leader of the Muslim world, including the Shia, who are also Muslims. So you have this Saudi-Iranian conflict, which is taking place, and the focus now is in Syria because the Iranians are supporting the guy who's in power, Assad, and the Saudis are supporting the rebels that are determined to overthrow him. So you have tremendous conflict there. You have the same conflict in Iraq. Iraq now has a Shia government, but the Sunnis are not participating in it, and the Saudis are helping the Sunnis cause trouble for the Shia government in Iraq. So you have this conflict between these two countries that is burning bright and causing a lot of problems because both are determined to prevail in the Middle East. On top of that, you have Russia versus the United States. As you know, Obama and the United States have been trying to figure out how much to get involved in a lot of these conflicts. And the two countries are really head-to-head in Syria. And the Russians are determined to see Assad, the guy who's in power now, who's an Alawite, which is part of the Shia sect. They are determined to see him prevail, and so are the Iranians. And the Americans have been beginning to support the Sunni opposition, arming them, training them. Then Obama now has pulled back. But there's still this competition between Russia and the United States. So you have layers of conflict going on at the same time. Then you have within Islam, as if that was not enough, a battle going on within Islam between various factions, between moderate Muslims, the Salafis, who are much more fundamentalist, some of whom are pacifist, and others want to take the war to wherever the war is, and a lot of them are going to Syria to help the Sunnis there. They call them the jihadis, those who want to go on jihad. And so you have a struggle for the soul and the minds of Muslims in the Arab world between, you know, do they want to follow a moderate course, or do they want to get involved in the struggle in Syria, or even overthrowing the governments in the countries where they live? And this is getting very heated. And in Tunisia, if we have time to talk about it, where I just came back from, the jihadis, the Salafis that really want to go to war. Some of them are in Syria, and some of them are now trying to overthrow the government in Tunisia, which is led by a moderate Islamic group. So you have this struggle within Islam between moderates and jihadis, radicals, extremists, and in some cases, both particularly in Tunisia, you have the moderates in power and you have the extremists who want to overthrow them. So that's another conflict on top of the conflicts we've already talked about. At the same time, we are seeing a counter-revolution take place. And the counter-revolution, that is, the countries that want to reverse everything that's happened in the Arab Spring and go back to the old status quo, the leader of the counter-revolution is Saudi Arabia. And they have a lot of money. It's a monarchy. And they were very instrumental in overthrowing the Muslim government just in July in Egypt, providing arms, and not arms, money and political support, and rushing immediately after Mohamed Morsi, who was the Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt. As soon as he was overthrown, the Saudis came rushing in with $5 billion of help to help the new government, run by the military now, take root and make a go of it. So you have this counter-revolution, not only of the Saudis and the Gulf monarchies against some of these new governments. You have part of the society, this is particularly true in Egypt, you have the secular parties, you have the army, you have the security forces who are part of the counter-revolution, who work together to throw out of power the Muslim Brotherhood that lasted exactly 1 year before they were expelled, overthrown by the military. So you have the counter-revolution within some countries, as well as some of the countries like Saudi Arabia that are determined to see the democracy movement defeated and to go back to the status quo. Now, in the middle of all this, two very interesting things are happening. And these are the shifts in international alliances. And it involves the United States in both cases. On the one hand, we are beginning to work with the Russians to try and solve some of these problems instead of competing with them. And we've just seen this happen now in Syria, where we worked together to force Assad to give up his chemical weapons. And we now have the UN and the Organization for, actually, the Chemical Disarmament, if you want to call it that, working to gain control of and scrap Syria's chemical weapons and their ability to manufacture them. And the United States and Russia are working hand in hand in this, exchanging information about what, you know, how much chemicals they have, where their chemical sites are. It's incredible to see the Russians and the Americans working like this. And on the other hand, we see now Obama trying to have an opening towards Iran and try and solve the nuclear issue with Iran in a peaceful diplomatic way rather than to have to go and bomb them. And if they're, you know, is it going to work? You know, there's a 50-50 chance they'll reach an agreement. If they do reach agreement, then I think they'll start working on other issues. And we will begin to see the end of 30 years of hatred between the United States and Iran. And this is a huge change in the Arab world and in our relations with Iran. So this, the result of this, our traditional allies, Saudis in the first place, are very nervous about what's happening because they are afraid we are going to make love with the Iranians and abandon them, stop supporting them, and this is going to weaken them in their struggle with Iran. So you have we're right on the cusp of whether these two new alliances are going to work, whether they're going to go anywhere or not. But if they do go somewhere, our allies, Saudis, the monarchies of the Gulf, Jordan, are going to be very upset because they are afraid that we are becoming friends with the Shia against the Sunnis. They are afraid that this will help Iran assert its hegemony and its power in the Gulf and throughout the Arab world. And so I don't know if you've been reading the papers in the last 2 weeks, but the Saudis have been putting out signals that they're going to pivot away from Washington. I don't know how they're going to do this, but they're so upset that they're beginning to look for other allies than the United States. So where does this leave the pro-democracy movement, which is where it all started, right, in the beginning of 2011? In Egypt, we've just seen pretty much the end of the pro-democracy movement. The military came in with the support of actually a lot of secular groups, liberal secular groups that said they are in favor of liberal democracy. And what did they do? They turned around and supported the military in their overthrow of the government because of their strong dislike of the Islamic government there. So in Egypt now, the feeling is that the chances for having a real democracy are not very bright, and that we're likely to have another military ruler. That country has been under military rule since 1952. We'll see the return of a military, the guy who's actually there now, Sisi, General Sisi, that he will get himself elected and we'll sort of go back to where we were before the Arab Spring began. Now, Tunisia, where I've just come from. Tunisia is what we call the last hope in the Arab world for democracy. There, the secular groups in the Islamic Renaissance Party, Ennahda it's called, we'll call it the Renaissance Party, have had to deal with each other because in the elections in 2011, the Islamist Party there only won 37% of the vote. And a whole bunch of secular parties split up the rest of it. So the Islamic government, they got a plurality. They had the biggest number. But they had to find secular allies in order to form a government. So for the last 2 years, the Islamic Party and two secular parties have been ruling together in what they call the Troika government. And this has provided the occasion for a lot of conflict, but also forced compromise between the Islamists and the secularists. in drawing up a new constitution. And this is why people are hopeful that they will find some way, a new constitution they can agree upon. They are now in the final stages of finishing the constitution, 1 year behind, 1 year late because of all the conflict. But there's still hope that you can, out of this will come some kind of multi-party democracy. In the next elections, everybody thinks the Islamic Party will not win 37%. They may win 25 to 30, but they'll still be the number one party. But they'll have to form a coalition government. So you begin to have real democratic practices. And one big difference between Tunisia and Egypt. In Tunisia, there's no army to intervene and overthrow anybody. It's a tiny army. It has a very strong apolitical tradition. It played no role in the uprising and is staying out of politics. So no party can go running to the military and say, help me overthrow my opponents. So there they all are, stuck together, arguing and squabbling, but they are now at the final stages of coming up with a new constitution, and then they'll have elections for a parliament. So there is still some hope that Tunisia will produce what I think will probably be the one and only democratic experiment to come out of the Arab Spring. So let me stay there and see what's on your mind. Huh? I didn't talk about Libya.
Just tell us your name.
My name is Noel Dean Evers. Hello. You didn't talk about Libya. Tell us what happens there.
Libya is a total mess. They haven't even been able to get together to form a constituent assembly to draw up a new constitution. It's all divided up into tribal areas and towns. It has just exploded. Nobody knows whether the country is going to stay together or the east and the eastern part of the country, which is a very strong, was kind of semi-autonomous before Gaddafi came to power in the late 60s. Whether it's going to split off or what's going to happen. They're having a terrible time. There are hundreds of militias, independent militias. And they go out, they've closed down the port, they go and they invade the parliament that's trying to meet because some local group did not get what it wants from the parliament, so they go in and invade parliament. They kidnapped and the prime minister, I think it was 3 weeks ago. It's a total mess. Making no progress. But they do have oil, so they can continue to pay people. Yes?
Hi, my name is... my name is Jordan Abawi, and I'm curious about the state of Jordan. This Syrian civil war has produced a lot of refugees flooding into this state. And to me, that's seeming to draw significant parallels to 1970 and Black September. What are your feelings on the possibilities of another Jordanian civil war?
Syrians, you know, the civil war before was between Palestinians, the PLO, and Palestinians in the so-called East Bank Jordanians, the Bedouin tribes. The Syrians are more outsiders. There are almost a million now in Jordan, and people are really worried about where this is going. But they're not involved in the politics the way the Palestinians were. And right now at the Woodrow Wilson Center, we have a Jordanian journalist, and he was telling me that the king there, King Abdullah, Western educated in the United States in prep school, is not at all liked by the Bedouin Eastern Jordanians. But everybody's so worried about the conflict in Syria on the border that nobody wants to cause trouble now. But that doesn't mean that they've had trouble in the camps. One of the camps is 150,000 people. It's, you know, it's the third largest city in Jordan now. is a Syrian camp. They're very worried about it, and particularly if this war drags on another year or 2 years. Would the Syrians turn against their host? You know, it's not the same thing as the Jordanians. Remember, in Jordan, half the population is Palestinian. So it's the Syrians are not Jordanian nationals. So it's a different mix. But that doesn't mean it's not a huge problem. And there could be incidents. Or Assad could start causing trouble in Jordan, using some of these refugees to, you know, place bombs and that sort of terrorism, to put pressure on the King of Jordan to stop supporting the opposition. I think that's the most likely kind of thing we're going to see. Yes?
My name is Devorah Mayorova, and I was wondering, do you believe Obama has other intentions with enforcing the chemical weapons treaty in Syria and getting on good terms such as oil benefits?
No, there's no oil in Syria.
Or around that area, do you think he...
No. No, I think they're using this opportunity to, you know, the Syrians don't have nuclear weapons, but the Syrians have always seen themselves as the main defender of the Arab world against Israel. Israel has nuclear weapons, it has chemical weapons, but everybody used to say Assad's Syria's chemical weapons were like a poor man's nuclear weapon. It was the one thing they could use if they ever got into a war with Israel. So I think both the Israelis and the U.S. government are delighted to get rid of the chemical weapons in Syria because it, in a way, it helps protect Israel from any kind of, you know, chemical attacks by the Syrians were there to be a war, an Arab-Israeli war. But oil, I don't really see oil playing a part of this calculation. And you got to remember, too, the reason he did this, got into this cooperation with the Russians, is that Congress was not going to back him in carrying out military strikes against Syria. That's how it happened. And he wasn't thinking about oil. He's trying to get out of a mess at home and on Capitol Hill. And when this opportunity came along, he grabbed it. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Vivian Nguyen, and I was wondering, what is the United States' current actions and involvement with these global issues?
With which?
With these global issues that you've talked about earlier.
Which global issues? Be a little bit more specific.
Well, you talked about like Shia and Sunni and everything, and I was wondering if the U.S. was doing anything about these issues as of now.
No. In fact, we've almost been too blind to the conflict between Sunnis and Shia. I mean, when we invaded Iraq, the U.S. government was not at all thinking about what might happen and how it would set off a struggle between Sunnis and Shia in Iraq. We were kind of like the deer caught in the bright light. I mean, you know, what? I mean, this is what's going to happen? I mean, it's kind of appalling how little we knew about the makeup of these countries and the kinds of conflicts they were likely to encourage. The U.S. invasion, in a way you can say the U.S. invasion of Iraq is the prime cause today of the conflict between the Shia and the Sunni. But we didn't set out to do that. But this started the conflict in Iraq, and then it spilled over into Syria, and it's the whole area is now infected with this, you know, this Sunni Shia struggle. And what to make things from the Sunni point of view, we ended up supporting a Shia government in Iraq. And that really made the Saudis furious. It made our Sunni friends furious, convinced them we didn't know what we were doing, because our allies are on the Sunni side for the most part. And no, we. But But we did cause this, unintended consequences of involvement. And that's one of the things that haunts Obama, the unintended consequences of getting involved in Middle East conflicts. Because you don't know where it's going to go and what you're going to cause to happen, even if you didn't want those things to happen. And it started in Iraq, and now, you know, Obama's worried about this. You stick your finger in, and you're, you know, what kind of reactions are you going to have? What kind of consequences, unintended, are going to happen? He didn't try to set out to do that. Or Bush, who was the one who started it in Iraq. Now, you know, Obama started helping the opposition in the Sunni opposition in Syria. Then he pulled back. Then he said, we're going to do it. Then he pulled back. And he's been dithering about whether to get involved in Syria or not get involved in Syria. And right now he's decided not. He's withdrawing. He's pulling back again. But if you mean our involvement in that issue, yes, we were the cause of a lot of this. But not by design. Yeah.
My name is Ryan Maitrey, and my question is really regarding Iran. And what are the odds? Well, first of all, Rouhani, is he more or less not a puppet of the Supreme Leader at the end of the day? And, I mean, if that's the case, and we kind of know how the Supreme Leader, where he usually falls in general, what are the odds that they're just not trying to buy time right now to finish up their weapons program? And, I mean, at the same time, I mean, how's that going to affect Israel? And we know that Israel wants to go in there and bomb them, and I know that Israel needs our assets and Iraqi airspace to get into Iran, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Nobody knows whether Rouhani has been authorized by Ayatollah Khamenei to make a serious compromise or not. They are hurting. Those sanctions are hurting. They need to change the internal Iranian economic situation. They can't do it without getting the boycott and lifted. The economic measures. They got to roll it back, or they're going to be in real trouble. But are they willing to make the compromise that is going to be sufficient to lift these sanctions? We don't know.
And the new intel coming out of there, if I'm wrong, is that they're much closer to having weapons grade plutonium ready.
Well, they can enrich to 20%, and to go to 20 to 90% is much easier than to go to 5 to 20%. So they have the capability now of enrichment, and that's why the Israelis say we got to stop their ability to enrich uranium. I think we're going to recognize their right to enrich uranium. I think we'll push for a 5% limit and try to get rid of all the uranium that's at 20%. And we will try and have the IAEA, the organization in Vienna, the Atomic Energy Agency, go in there and inspect and try to keep absolute control of their facilities, or at least, if not control, monitoring what's going on and whether there's any increase in the amount of uranium being enriched above 5%. Question, will the Israelis accept this? That's their position.
Right.
And they keep saying, we're reserving the right to act alone.
And can we prove, though, that they actually reduced their uranium from 25%? I mean, you don't really know because everything's so hush-hush.
Oh, no, the IAEA knows. They know how much is 20%, how much is 5%. The IAEA does a pretty good job of monitoring there. That, I think, we will know. But for the problem is you can have a breakout. And the judgment is that they could have created at least one bomb in 6 to 9 months. And for the Israelis, they would know it. They would know, I think, that this was happening. Because in order to do it, they would have to kick out the IAEA inspectors. But I'm not sure. I don't know what the Israelis are going to do. They don't want to go alone without the United States. But if the United States makes a deal with Iran, then they've got to decide. Well, they, yeah, I think they cross, they get across. They might even get across Saudi airspace. The Saudis are so upset about Iran, nuclear. To me, it's not impossible to fly across Saudi Arabia. Free. No intercepts. Yes?
Okay. Hi, my name is Muna Omar. My question also focuses on Israel. First of all, like, what is Israel's influence in all of these conflicts that we have going on? And second, how might the relationship with Iran, an American-U.S. relationship with Iran, be strain our relationship with Israel? And then thirdly, seeing how the Syrian conflict has come up as on top.
Yeah.
I was wondering, are we even farther away than solving the Palestinian conflict there?
What a question. Start with the last one. He's working on the Palestinian conflict. You know, they have 9 months to do it. We'll see by the middle of next year whether they made any progress in getting there. The Israelis have not been, they've been involved in a number of strikes in Syria to prevent weapons going to Hezbollah in Lebanon. But they haven't been, I haven't seen any evidence at all they're supporting any of the rebel groups, you know, in that way. They don't want sophisticated weapons going into Lebanon to be used by Hezbollah against Israel. So I don't think Israel is, their one concern is the Golan Heights. And they would rather, they certainly want to have sort of the secular rebel groups rather than the Islamic rebel groups in the Golan Heights. And I do think they possibly have been talking to the Saudis about this, because the Saudis have a lot of influence over the rebels in that area, in the Golan Heights area. And so there may be some cooperation on that issue there. That's the only place I've seen them involved. On Israel, America, and Iran, I think this is an extremely interesting period. I think what we're seeing is Obama defining U.S. interests that are different from Israeli interests. This is one of those times where the U.S. and Israel may be about to be going separate ways on the issue of Iran. Because I think Obama, in the end, is going to accept the Iranian right to enrich uranium, and this is going to be a real problem for the Israelis, and that we're going to have real tension in the Israeli-American relationship, just as we're developing real tension in our relation with Saudi Arabia on the same issue. Both the Israelis and the Saudis say it is not sufficient to prevent the Iranians from having nuclear weapons. You have to prevent them from having the nuclear weapons capability. And the Saudis and the Israelis have exactly the same position on this. And I don't think that's our position. I think, in fact, Obama says we want to prevent them from having nuclear weapons, but he doesn't say we're going to prevent them from having nuclear weapons capability. This is a very interesting time in our relationship with Israel.
My name is Michael Affleck.
Hey,
and
Michael.
I was just curious about Tunisia. You said that Tunisia was becoming more democratic, and it was one of the democratic hopefuls in the Middle East.
The last.
Like, why would you say what caused Tunisia to be more democratic, and what could possibly spread that to the surrounding countries?
You know, each country in this Arab Spring is unique. In Tunisia, Tunisia is unique. You know, one of the main forces carrying out the uprising in Tunisia were the labor unions. It's the only country in the Arab world that has very strong labor unions. The Labor Confederation, called the UGTT, was set up in 1946. It has been there forever. They were involved in the battle for independence, and they were in the uprising. They organized because they're organized all across the country. And it was the labor unions that sent the word about what was happening in this town, city, Bouzid, and got people organized and out in the streets. They played a really crucial role. Totally unique. There's no other country in the Arab world where the labor unions played any role like this in the uprising. So they're very strong. They are today cooperating with the Chamber of Commerce, which is also a strong secular group, the lawyers, and human rights group. They formed this quartet, and they have been negotiating with the Islamic government, forcing them to give up power before elections are held for a parliament. So my point is, you have these civil society groups that have stood up to the government and are forcing them to make compromises. This is really unique. But it's such a, Tunisia has such a strong civil society that there is some hope for democracy coming out of this. I mean, some days I think it's not going to work, and some days I think there's still a chance. But because of the strong civil society in that country, because the labor unions are strong, because you have a balance between the Islamic party and the secular parties, no party can prevail on its own, so they have to compromise. You know, there's some hope for a coalition government and democracy coming out of this. So right now I'm hopeful. When I left, I wasn't. Because it was a real mess. The Islamic government was not willing to step down, and they were digging in their heels, and it looked like there was going to be real trouble. But so that's why almost everybody's looks at Tunisia as the last best hope for the Arab Spring.
Name is George Fifita. I think you might have answered this question, but I'll ask again. But Syria, weren't they a part of Israel in biblical times? And number two, can you comment on the relations between Syria and Israel?
Between Syria and Israel? Were they part of... Well, you know, the whole area was the same. I mean, it was all... Biblical times, you know. I'm not a scholar of the Bible or the Torah or whatever. You know, I mean, I don't. Biblical times, it was all one area. It was a part of Rome, the Roman. You know, I don't know where the Roman divisions were exactly, but yeah, the whole area was one area. Relations between Israel and Syria, under Assad, they understood each other. The Israelis liked Assad because there was never any infiltration across the Golan Heights. Kept the peace. Assad talked tough, but he didn't. He knew the rules of the game. They understood each other. Now the Israelis don't know what's going to happen, because they don't know whether Assad's going to be there or whether he's going to be strong enough to impose his control over the Golan Heights, or they're going to be rebel groups there for a long time to come. It's much more uncertain, and the relationship between Assad and Israel no longer works in terms of controlling the Golan or controlling the crazies, what the Israelis regard as the crazies, as Islamic extremists who really hate Israel and might, you know, end up attacking on their own. So it's very unstable, the relationship.
Hi, my name is Brianna Hi. Johnson, and this is a question more about yourself.
About what?
What made you first interested in studying the Middle East?
I didn't hear.
What made you first interested in studying the Middle East?
You know how it started? I was a junior. I took my junior year off, although I didn't get any credit at Harvard. I went and studied in France, 1959, 1960. Charles de Gaulle was the president. There was an attempted coup to overthrow de Gaulle by the by the army in Algeria, because Algeria was still under the control of the French. And I lived in a house, a home. They had two young kids, and one of them lived in Algeria. And I was invited down to Algeria in the middle of the what was going on, this war between France and the Algerian nationalists. And I went down and I got really interested in the war. And that started my sort of beginning of my interest in the Arab world. And you have to remember that time in Paris, the bombs were going off. The Algerian nationalists were causing a lot of problems in Paris. It was the issue. The major newspaper, the Le Monde in Paris, used to publish with blank spaces on the front page because they were objecting to the government censorship about the war in Algeria. Can you imagine, I mean, reading the Washington Post, the New York Times, or L.A. Times, or, you know, your local newspaper, and there are blanks in the paper because of censorship? I mean, you know, it was, the Algerian war was in Paris. So everybody was, the whole student world was consumed by the Algerian war. And then I happened to know, because of this family, I went down there and visited Algeria in the middle of the war. So that's how I got interested. And then the first thing I did when I got out of college, I worked for a news agency that sent me to Algiers. 1 month after their independence, it was total chaos. They were fighting for power among the nationalist groups. It was, and I discovered that being a foreign correspondent is really interesting. That's how I got involved.
I'm sorry, that's all the time we have for our forum, but please join me in thanking David Attaway for a very interesting and informative forum.